ऐसी मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to the Attention Please podcast, now on video. If you like this podcast, kindly do like, share, and subscribe. You know what to do. So at the time of recording, the Russian forces have surrounded the city of Kiev. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And they're waiting, based on very recent reports that I've read. They're waiting because primarily, I mean, they've been shelling their advanced positions. So they're trying to weaken the city of Kiev. They're trying to reduce it to rubble so that they can walk in. But right now, they're kind of in a holding position, principally because they have experienced a little bit more of resistance than they were expecting. They had expected the Ukrainian government to essentially flee, and they would then just walk in unimpeded. That has not happened. The Ukrainians are putting up, at the time of writing, a heroic struggle. Normal men and women have been armed, and they're patrolling the streets. So it's not that it's going to push Putin back. I mean, this is a guy who has no conscience and who has no compunction in killing people, killing innocent civilians. So he's going to march in. It's just that he's now waiting for the more... right now, what he sent was his advanced force. From what I read, they were primarily conscripts. So they're people who were kind of forced to fight because they had to in Russia. But now he's going to send the real professional soldiers, the people who can kill without remorse and who can kill without conscience. Because that's what it's going to come down to. It's going to come down to street battle, exactly what it was in, let's say, Bosnia. So it's going to come down to that kind of home-to-home kind of battle, which, you know, that it takes a certain amount of ruthlessness, and Putin's just trying to get those guys on the ground. So this peace, I hope that there is a negotiated solution, but I'm not hopeful at this point of time. I mean, Putin has played his hand. But anyways, this podcast today is not really about current breaking news. I'm going to guess that you will be looking at CNN for that. And by the way, CNN is, you know, it's normally extremely boring and unwatchable during normal times. But when it's war, when it's something like this, CNN has a leg up over every other channel, at least from what I get, what I see. I don't know what BBC is doing because I don't get BBC here. But CNN's coverage has been really great. In terms of, you know, they have reporters, you know, standing there with the Russians walking behind them. So the topic for today's podcast was, I wanted to talk about Putin in the larger historical context of what's going on. It's not so much, you know, an hour by hour breaking story. That's not really why you listen to this podcast or see this podcast on YouTube. So the first question is, why is Vladimir Putin invading Ukraine? So in order to understand this question, which is, again, you could go on and on, you can write a book on this, but if you first understand that Vladimir Putin is a totalitarian dictator. So unlike in a democracy like the US or the UK, where what Biden does isn't necessarily what Biden does, he has to consult a lot of people. There are a lot of centers of influence within the government. So when Biden says something, it's not necessarily what he would have said if he was the only guy in the room. This is not true for Putin and in any totalitarian regime, where it's basically he's the only guy who matters. If anybody doesn't like him, well, there's the firing squad for you. So what does Putin represent? So Putin represents a really hardcore Russio-Christian nationalism, which is driven by expansionist fantasies, like any kind of nationalism is. And this has formed really the core of the communist rule in Russia. Now, what communism did is that it provided a convenient ideological cocoon for this kind of nationalism. So when the Russians were expanding, they were not expanding because, you know, they hated everybody else. They were expanding as representatives of the working class to liberate other working classes from the evil dictatorship of the capitalist overlords. That was the comforting myth that they created in order to justify their naked aggression. This is what communism actually is. Communism at its heart essentially creates these class-based conflicts to justify aggression in whatever form it is. And this fit perfectly into this whole Russian Christian nationalism that has existed in Russia for decades, ages, and predates communism. This expansionist nationalism is exactly what drove Stalin. It is exactly what led to the whole notion of spheres of influence and the Iron Curtain. And it is what led to the reduction of Eastern Europe to becoming vassals with USSR-installed governments. And again, as I said, this predates the USSR and predates communism. It just latched onto communism, as I said, a convenient ideological cocoon. That's the only thing. So the focus of the expansion of Russia has historically always been Ukraine, which has seen targeted genocide by Russian rulers from the era of Catherine the Great, who's regarded as a hero in Western history, and of course, Stalin. Stalin's pogroms in Ukraine, I mean, there was no information, but hundreds and thousands of people were killed. So this was done to kind of change the demographics of Ukraine to make it more Russian. And if this reminds you of a certain other dictator in Europe, this is precisely what he tried to do and what, you know, Russian expansion, Russian nationalism had tried to do, again, under the guise of communism for decades. So when Putin, and he still speaks of, when Putin speaks of, if you saw the rationale that Putin gave for his naked act of aggression, was he spoke of all these Russian zones in Ukraine. This is very, very similar to Hitler's attack into Sudetenland, by the way. So he speaks of these Russian zones in Ukraine, the so-called Donbas region. And he talks about this non-existent genocide of Russians. And he calls the Ukrainians Nazis, by the way. This is their old, fascists. This is their old, you know, it's not fascist to be fascist to a fascist, being said by the biggest fascist, Putin. This is the irony of the whole thing. But he's talking about this non-existent genocide. There is no genocide. It is not recorded. Nobody knows about this genocide. So it's just an excuse. So he's talking about these Russian zones within Ukraine. Those were actually settled by Russians. They didn't spontaneously come up there. This was part of the demographic change that Russians have sought. This is the part of that expansionist fantasy. The fact that the eastern part of Ukraine is largely dominated by Russians, they were put there, they were settled there over decades in order to Russify Ukraine. So this again is the leading edge of the sphere, but this is the spear, but this is not something new. So Putin just basically represents a continuation of that legacy that started from Catherine the Great through to Stalin, and now it has come to fruition within Vladimir Putin. So specifically for Putin, what he's trying to do is, Ukraine is just part one of his larger endeavor, which is to restore the old USSR. And he's pushing for the kind of bipolar world that it used to be before. So this is not the first time he has seized republics that broke away from USSR, and he's kind of brought them back in. He started off in Georgia, Chechnya, and he installed puppets there in the old world Soviet style. That's what the Soviets used to do. The ruse of them being independent republics, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, had to be maintained, even though they were all puppets of the mothership Russia. And then what they did was they seized back Crimea from Ukraine. Now, Crimea had been given to Ukraine by Russia. It was a part of Russia, actually, which was given to Ukraine as a gesture of goodwill by Khrushchev. This was a time when he was trying to, you know, mend fences with the Ukrainians for, you know, centuries of having abused Ukrainians. But now the first thing that Putin did, like an angry, petulant child, was to take that back. That's mine. You guys took that from me. So he took back Crimea. So he's been expanding for a while, for decades now, and now he's up against really the biggest impediment towards his vision of creating a unified USSR. So he's up against the second largest republic from USSR, which is Ukraine. Now, Ukraine has oil and precious minerals, which makes it a very attractive target for imperialism. And that's really been one of the reasons why it has always been a target for Russia, because Ukraine is also very, very rich inherently. And by the way, Ukraine also, just like the Russian oligarchs who control oil and precious minerals in Russia, and they became wealthy because when the USSR collapsed, they were basically able to sell whatever the old USSR had, government assets. They basically took them over. They basically, I remember reading about this, that there was this guy who was in charge of, he was the guy who used to open the factory and used to clean the factory early in the morning. The only thing was he had the keys. So when the USSR collapsed, he had a key to, I think, a copper plant. So he basically took ownership of the copper plant and sold all the copper and became a millionaire. He just had the keys to the place, that's all. He used to come and wipe the floors in the morning. So, and there was no rule at that point of time. I either read it or a friend of mine from Russia told me this story. But this was how the Russian oligarchs were made. There was total abdication of authority. There was no authority left. So whatever people had, they just took, and they took it legally, illegally. I mean, is it illegal if there is no law? I don't know. But they just did finders keepers and took over very, very precious USSR assets and sold them in the open market and became millionaires and billionaires, including obviously Russian military assets. That was really what the most important thing was, but also mineral assets, mining rights, everything. They just took it over. So what the point I'm trying to say is that just as Putin is a Russian oligarch and he has a set of Russian oligarchs, Ukraine also has their set of oligarchs. And this accession of Ukraine is basically one set of oligarchs trying to take over the territory of another set of oligarchs. It's a gang war. And I'm tempted to go put a gunda line here and say gang war shuru hone wala hai, but I won't, because I want to keep this a little serious. But most of all, when you ask why is Putin invading Ukraine, you have to understand that, again, it is driven by Putin's own emotions. And again, since he's a totalitarian dictator, there's no control over his emotion. There's nobody who can say, boss, this we can't do. Whatever he says, it happens. So this is the humiliation of Russia. And again, this kind of brings you back to the humiliation of Germany at the Treaty of Versailles, which is what many historians see kind of triggered Hitler forward. So it's again the humiliation of Russia after its collapse. So when this whole in the late 90s, when there was, again, the last time there was a major war in Europe was in Bosnia. So Bosnia in that area was seen by USSR, then Russia, because USSR no longer existed, to be in its sphere of influence. It was in its neighborhood. So there was an expectation that the Russians would be consulted. But NATO, the USA basically said, you know what, you guys step away, you guys are insignificant, we will just do things. So this was taken as a personal affront. And as far as I know, Putin has said this. So this is not anybody conjecturing. So this kind of was that last straw on the proverbial camel's back for Putin, that the reason why this kind of hurt his pride, that Russia in his own neighborhood, the US was coming and dictating terms in their own neighborhood, what he felt. And again, remember that at that point of time, he had been groomed to become the next generation of rulers of the old USSR, and the USSR fell. So there was also a sense of, like, they took my country away from me. They didn't technically take his country away from me, but they took his imagination of what the country was away from him, true. So that's why he's trying to restore that imagination. So he felt personally hurt by that. And, you know, that started a great hatred of America, of democracy. I mean, he was a KGB guy, so it wasn't that he was a particularly democratic guy anyways. But what he has always imagined himself, that someday apna time aayega, and now he thinks it's his time. So this, he's been working up to this for all of his life. This invasion of Ukraine is a decision taken in haste. Don't think that. I mean, he's built his own life. This is his lifetime, because he knows that he's kind of reached a stage after which there is not going to be any going back. If he loses this war, this might be the end of him. And he didn't need to do this. He's a very, very, very rich guy. So he could have just stayed and lived off his riches. But no, this is not just a guy trying to make himself rich, which he is. This is not even craziness. This is, and I don't know whether I should use the word, but I'll use it. This is evil at this point of time. This is the pure evil of trying to take what is not his. It is a pure evil fantasy of domination. It is an evil fantasy, and I hesitate to use the word evil, but I'm using it anyways, to dominate and to conquer a place which he thinks he owns. It's his right, because he believes it's his right. He does not recognize the agency of the citizens there. It's his right because it used to be the USSR's and it was his to rule. That's really what's going on in his head. And he's basically said this many times. He hasn't said it in so many words, but which brings me to the second question. Why now? What exactly happened? Well, one is, of course, it's the COVID crisis is kind of petering out. I say this with, you know, fingers crossed, because this can be a variant at any point of time. So, you know, he can do this right now. Otherwise, you know, he could put his army and then this army could get COVID and get, and that's something which he obviously didn't want. The other thing is, of course, the Nord Stream pipeline. So Nord Stream 1, which is a pipeline, it runs through Ukraine. So one of the protections that Ukraine always had is that the main oil pipeline that Russia uses to reach markets within Europe, and Germany is, I think, 50% of its energy needs come from Russia, is that it goes through Ukraine. So if it attacked Ukraine, Ukraine had the power to damage their pipeline. So this was kind of what led to a detente between Russia and Ukraine. Now what, and obviously it's fairly obvious that's exactly why Nord Stream 2 was being built under the Baltic Sea, to kind of short circuit out Ukraine. Because obviously Putin has been building up to this all his life. And the oil companies, they're all controlled by the oligarchs who are all controlled by him. So it's really him who's been building all of this. So Nord Stream 2 had been actually been under sanctions under Trump. And the sanctions were removed under Biden. And it was, well, it was the US government too, but it was mostly under pressure from Germany and the other European countries who depended on Nord Stream 2 because it would definitely reduce the cost of oil for them. So this, now that Nord Stream, now they've again imposed sanctions on Nord Stream 2 after his attack. But that's, he's basically built the pipeline. So it exists. Russia no longer singularly depends. There's no single point of failure for Russia anymore. That's a big deal. And that's what Putin has now. The third is that Ukraine has been in conversation with NATO for a significant period of time. So as the NATO is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which was created after World War II, as a way of, if Russia, it was any country, but it was really Russia. If USSR attacks any of the countries which were in Western Europe, that is, they left out the countries which had fallen behind the Iron Curtain. But the next line, if the USSR attacked any of those countries, then all the other signatories of NATO were bound by the treaty to join them. This is what many people felt kept the peace. Now, after the dissolution of USSR, there are many countries in erstwhile Eastern Europe who wanted to join NATO because they still hadn't forgotten what Russia did. And what I'm saying isn't something which people there hadn't seen. I mean, they had borne the brunt of Russian imperialism for centuries. So this was not the first time that Russia had, you know, kind of crossed and tried to invade their countries. So they knew what might happen. So many of these countries were tried to get into NATO, and some of them got in, like Romania got into NATO and Poland got into NATO. None of these things were things that people like Putin liked, because of course Putin's fantasy is to get those places back. But then the last straw on the camel's back was Ukraine. Ukraine was trying to join NATO. And this was an absolute no-no for Putin, joining NATO. Because then, of course, he could never bring back at least his own USSR, because then in order to, if he took over, if Ukraine has a part of NATO today, then we would already have World War III at this point of time, because all nations would have to be involved. Now, again, there's some people would say that what is the trigger after which, like they say, somebody sinks a ship of Romania, which has happened, I think. Is that a trigger for NATO joining in? It's usually not. There's usually a trigger that after this, yes, then all of us will fight. But I think what's happened to Ukraine, that's a fairly, you know, everybody would say that's a trigger, right? If they walk into your country and circle your capital city, yeah, that's a trigger. So the only reason that Russia could do it right now is because Ukraine didn't sign, isn't a part of NATO. So Ukraine was trying to be a part of NATO. They could have become a part of NATO at this point of time. And this was really something which worried Putin. So he wanted to preemptively strike before they became a part of NATO. This is a time for a little bit of a sidelight at this point of time, for those of you who don't know, that when the USSR was dissolved, broke up, Ukraine had the third largest stockpile of nuclear weapons. I mean, these were originally Russian weapons, instances of some USSR weapons, but they were physically located in Ukraine. So Ukraine suddenly became the third largest stockpile of nuclear weapons, the third largest nuclear-enabled country in the world. So what happened at that point of time was the U.S. pressurized them to sign something which we in India, who grew up in the 90s, heard a lot about, which was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which basically said only adults like the U.S. and Russia can keep nuclear weapons. All of you chote mote bachches don't have the right to have nuclear weapons or pursue nuclear weapons. If you guys try to, we will sanction you and, you know, create life miserable for you. This was really what this extremely, extremely, I mean, you can see this was Dadagiri, nothing more than Dadagiri. The NPT was that. And NPT was being used against India. India was under great pressure to sign the NPT. There was somebody called Robin Raphael, for those of you who remember from those days, who was later investigated as being a plant for Pakistan, by the way, who was in, and she was Hillary Clinton's, you know, right arm. She was pressurizing India to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Ukraine signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and they gave up their nuclear weapons under the obligation that they would be protected by, believe it or not, USA and Russia. Guess how that turned out. So at that point of time, when we went nuclear, remember, we refused to do the NPT, and Vajpayee came under immense amount of criticism from within India for not signing NPT and then going and, you know, exploding an atomic bomb and essentially ensuring that we could not go back. They couldn't go back and then make us sign NPT, because when you have a nuclear bomb, you have a nuclear bomb. You can't do NPT anymore, essentially. So this, and remember this, remember the people who at that point of time said that India was doing something terrible. Look at what happens what might have happened to us if we had gone down Ukraine's path. Remember, by the way, Ukraine thoroughly condemned India at that point of time because they had been made to sign the NPT. So I can understand them being a little pissed because they had all this stuff, they gave it away, and they see India then bursting their nuclear, you know, a nuclear bomb and becoming a nuclear power. And they were like, well, what just happened to us? Well, now you realize the sagacity of the Indian government at that point of time. Now, a question that many people would say is that, won't sanctions hurt? I mean, the US is putting like sanctions on them every day. We're putting, you know, they're going to take you out of SWIFT. We're not going to buy oil. The thing is that, and everybody knows this, that sanctions ultimately end up hurting common people. It ends up hurting Russians. Putin doesn't give a flying fuck. And see, Putin is not a democratically elected technically, but we all know how democratic Russia is. So he doesn't have to go back and ask for votes, right? So Putin doesn't care if his citizens are under enormous. He will just say, you know, look at how evil the Americans are. The USSR never had a problem with deprivations. I mean, that's how they won World War II. They basically destroyed areas of their own country to create this whole scorched earth thing when the Nazis came. So they don't really care for their own citizens. Now, Putin, who's a billionaire, will be able to sell his oil. Sanctions in US, this just means the US won't buy. There'll always be customers for oil. And, you know, they don't have to directly buy it from Russia. There'll always be an indirection at this point of time. So his oil will get out. There will be buyers for Russian oil. And now what's going to happen is that oil prices are going to go through the roof. And when that happens, him and his oligarch friends, they lost a lot of money due to the COVID oil plunge. They're going to recover all of that and much more. Add to it the components that go to make chips, and you have the existence of the unregulated and untraceable crypto black hole, don't worry. Russian oligarchs and Putin have made contingencies for themselves. They are not going to go penniless and be on the streets. They're going to profit from this. Putin wouldn't have done this if he wasn't personally going to profit from this. Yes, profit is definitely a motive, but more than that, it's that nationalism, that Russian nationalism. Which brings me to the last point, which I think is perhaps the most important and perhaps the most tragic. So I believe that Russia definitely helped Trump get elected. I wouldn't say they rigged the elections. That kind of makes it seem as if they either rigged the ballot boxes or they somehow did a Jedi mind trick on American voters. That's overstating, but they definitely helped Trump. They actively colluded with Trump to get him elected. And why did they do that? The real reason is that, see, Putin realizes that the reason, and he's right, the reason the Russians lost, the USSR lost the Cold War, was that entire America was united against USSR. A very, very powerful country was, to the man, united against USSR. No matter what you felt, no matter what your political opinion was, no matter what anything, what any opinion people had, the Russians and the USSR were always the villain. There was nobody, not even the biggest liberals, could say that, yeah, you know, these are kind of good. I mean, there would be some extreme members of the US Communist Party, which was in any case a minuscule minority, but it was, the nation was pretty much united against the USSR. On the other hand, people in USSR were not united against the US. I mean, given half a chance, people would try to defect to the US. So there was a huge asymmetry there. And he realized that. He realized the fact that it's never going to happen that people from the US are going to try to defect to USSR or Russia. That's not going to happen. But the fact was that Russians wanted to support US, and the US didn't, there was nothing coming back. So it's not a question of attrition. It was all one-way traffic. Now, electing Trump was, and it kind of makes him look like a Bond villain to think of something as grand as this. And I don't think he really thought, maybe he kind of imagined this happening, and it did. Because a lot of things need to fall into place. And I'm coming to what happened was that, you know, it divided America to an extent that I have not seen America being divided. And I've been in this country since 99. So in his army of social media bots, what they did was they amplified this political distinctions in the US. They were tweeting outrageous things, pretending to be one side, and tweeting outrageous things, pretending to be the other side. So now what has happened because of this is that, and again, we can't just stop at him. As I have always said in my podcast, one kind of extremism is supported by the other kind of extremism. They're their best friends. So then the progressive woke extremism took in organically. So what happened was that, and it's happening right now as we speak, is that large sections of US population, shockingly to me, I'm not part of that, shockingly to me, are saying, you know what, Putin's not that bad a guy. And Steve Bannon, of course, the intellectual fountainhead of Trumpism, said, you know what, at least Putin is not woke. And Tucker Carlson, who's an extremely popular media figure, went on a rant 2 days ago saying, you know what harm has Putin done to me, essentially? Why should I oppose him? What has he done to me? It was kind of channeled, I think, Muhammad Ali, who said, I ain't got no quarrel with the Viet Cong. So in this culture war, this is amazing, is that people feel more, many significant portions of Americans feel more close to Putin than they feel to their own president culturally, which is what I've always stressed, that the whole notion of a nation is a kind of cultural and value affinity. It's not a physical boundary. It's not defined by its borders. It's defined by an affinity in values and beliefs. And this is what I think Putin's real, and again, he's been helped by the other side. So I wouldn't just, ascribe it to Putin's evil genius. But this is what he's done. He's managed to divide the US in a way that it was never divided during the Cold War. And that is what gives me, because we don't know what's going to happen with Ukraine, but he's not going to stop with Ukraine. I don't think he's going to. If he gets Ukraine and he's able to pretty much put together the USSR, he's definitely going to go on to bigger things. And that's the thing with evil dictators like Putin, is that you have to stop him in the very beginning. Once they start moving, once they get that momentum, it's very difficult to stop that juggernaut. We've seen that in World War II. Once that juggernaut starts, I mean, initially they could have stopped Hitler pretty easily. Hitler wasn't very powerful initially. That's the thing with Putin. Is this the end? I'm absolutely sure it's not going to be the end if he gets Ukraine. So the real worry for me is how divided. Ultimately, the only power that can still stop USSR / Russia is the US. It still has, militarily, it is, if you engage in a military conflict with USA, still, I don't think you're walking away alive, given the overwhelming arsenal that US has. I mean, people say China and everything, but on paper, man, you put it against US and you put against the kind of tech that the US military has. US falters in places like Afghanistan. They falter in places like Afghanistan. Why? Because the Afghanis don't want them. That's why they falter. The Afghanis don't care. They would prefer the Taliban. See, that's the main problem with Afghanistan and Iraq. They preferred the ISIS. They preferred Saddam. They preferred the Taliban. In the US, like, you are the conquerors. You are the imperialists. Now, over in Ukraine, that's not the case. If Putin extends into Europe, it's not that the common people will not be supporting the US. When US intervened in World War II, the European people supported the US. So that's the important thing. So once US has that support of the citizens they're claiming to protect, the US is still unstoppable, in my opinion. But the thing that Putin has done is that it's kind of clawed away at the cohesion, at that cultural unity that makes US. And again, I'm not going to just blame this old Putin. He's kind of ripped apart the fabric a little bit, but the rips were already there. And he's been helped a lot by extreme progressives in the US political space. Absolutely. And this is where we have come. And that's why the second part of the podcast is important too. Why it's happening now. So let's see what happens. We are living in sad times, I would say. It's terrible to see videos of fathers saying goodbye to their daughters and old people at the twilights of their lives having to take arms to defend their homes. It is beyond tragic for no reason at all. After coming out from COVID, we will have to have millions of people have died for no good reason to see man doing this. But it was not preventable. But here this is, just to see human folly so close to COVID, to see that human beings are ready as humanity to even have this. It's just disappointing. But it also, that's why I've used the word evil. At this point of time, this is so unprovoked. I understand long-standing, festering conflicts. Both sides have a point. This is a conflict when both sides don't have a point. Only one side has a point. The other side is a naked aggressor. This is old-style imperialism and aggression. And no matter what you feel about anything, you have to stand against what Putin is doing. You have to be on Team Ukraine. I am. I mean, there is no justification for what Putin is doing. Absolutely none. And no matter what you feel on other topics, no matter what you feel, it is important to prioritize what's most important. And right now, in my mind, there is no greater threat than Vladimir Putin. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next podcast.